philosophers in space, 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 space.
Oops, ain't gonna cut it, Mr. Glowing Visage, beautiful beyond all description.
These are my disposables, exposition and comic relief.
No functions.
Darling, those are genders.
I would like to see the baby.
If it makes you feel any better, the apocalypse is coming soon. Bury your gold. You've been buying gold, right?
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. This is episode 200. The big 200. Final one for old Thomas. Oh boy, I'll try to contain. Okay. So yeah, I'm Thomas, ex-co-host of this very podcast. How are you doing, Aaron?
Oh, Thomas, my friend, my co-creator, the deadpan Peter Weller to my gooey talking bug anus. Are you
I've been called that a lot, weirdly. Like, it's, man, that's the second time today, actually. What are the odds? I was just talking to somebody at the grocery store.
Oh, I was trying to be special. You know? I was trying to make this last one unique.
I can't even repeat the phrase you said because it was so weird. Like, when my kids talk gibberish, it's you can't repeat it because it's not real words.
Yeah, we've gotten so cliche, haven't we, buddy? Just so many times on that psychosexual table.
Well, and we're doing a really cool thing where it's like, let's say you break up with someone, but as you do, their new partner who's way hotter than you is in the room, like during the breakup. And you're like, that's cool. We're doing that. Welcome, Callie, back to the show. Been too long. How are you doing, Callie?
I'm having a great time. This is a wonderful introduction.
At least I picked some content that specifically has a weird relationship that vaguely mirrors exactly what you're describing there. So, you know, at least we're on brand on as many points as possible.
This is a big reveal.
There are so many more reasons why this was a good pick for my first episode.
This is such right a great reveal. I never dreamed that I would be replaced by someone so much better as a co-host. And it makes it great. Like, I'm really happy that the show is going to be in good hands. But it's also going to make it really awkward that a lot of people are going to have to be like, oh, no, Thomas, don't go. So we'll get a lot of that. That's okay, though. I'm really glad that, Callie, you agreed to step in because, wow, what a lucky pickup for Aaron here. I'm really excited for this.
Aw, thank you. That is legitimately very meaningful to me. Thank you. Yeah, I was really stoked when I got the message because, like, beyond the scope of the podcast, there's a lot happening in my life right now. Just a whole lot happening in my life right now. And, like, it just gotten to the point where it's like, you know what? Things are smoothing out, settling down. Maybe I can start turning my attention to the outside world a little more. And I swear it was maybe 2 or 3 days after I had that thought that Aaron reached out to me. And I was like, oh, wow. So we're just going to dive right into the deep end there.
Cool. What does it all mean?
Cool. Yeah. You know, as the awkward other partner, I like have all of the balance of things that's being described there. Like, I think, I picked this piece partly because I think it gives us a way to talk some about the weirdness of podcasting and podcasting relationships.
Callie, this movie is just like podcasting. The same thing as podcasting.
Every other week you show up and I have to cut another organ out of you. That's pretty much the way our relationship has worked. And, like, you know, I think it's totally normal and fine and good to want to do different projects after a while. And so I think it can both be true that, like, we had a great 200 episodes and Callie and I will also hopefully get to have a great at least 200 episodes. Oof. And they will be both fun versions of this show.
Now that's like that breakup table situation I talked about before, but you guys are already talking about marriage. Jeez, like right in front, barely even broken up. And you're just like, yeah, we're having a couple kids.
I mean, I think it's like Trill where, you know, you're just... you know, there's nothing wrong with wanting to sleep with every different iteration of a particular trill, right? That's not weird. That's just, you know.
All right, what is this reference? Is this something?
Not. You know, different versions. It's fine.
We have already moved on from you, Thomas. I'm so sorry.
No, that's great. No. This is some Star Trek thing that you know that I don't. That's fantastic.
That you embody, but sure, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
What?
Yeah, no, I don't know what you're talking about. I think it's a fun one. Yeah, no, just trolling. They're the worm people that worm jumps from person to person and they carry all the memories with them. It's a basic concept. Personhood over time joke. You know, you're worms of Theseus, essentially.
Oh, am I going to be consumed by Cali by the end of this? I'm actually going to be... I didn't know that was part of it.
There's some sort of weird Cronenberg-y creature.
We didn't tell you what the end of the ritual is, but get inside this crock pot here.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say part of the investment in the partnership that we figured out is that we actually bought one of the machines from the movie.
Great.
And so,
well, speaking of, why don't we get on over to the weirdest movie? It's, you know, the last day, rules are out the window.
Yeah.
Your last day on the job. I'm going to steal a stapler on the way out. But no, let's get on over to the weirdest movie I've ever seen, probably. That's not true. Okay. On this very show, not even the weirdest movie on this very show, but one of the weirder ones I've ever seen. The final Cronenberg for my purposes, the newest Cronenberg, Crimes of the Future. Crimes of Future Past. Days of Crime Days.
Back to the Future Crimes.
Future Crimes of the Past.
And I guess... one of two movies of his that are completely unrelated but have the same title?
Yeah, I just found that out a moment ago.
That's a bold move. May or may not have had an anxiety attack over whether I had watched the correct one until I went back and I saw Aaron was like his latest. And I was like, okay, cool.
What a gutsy move. It's like Tolkien just wrote another book called The Hobbit and was like, yeah, it's not the same one. I'm just writing another one called The Hobbit for fun. Weird.
Yeah, and
I'm just going to read a sentence from the description of the 1970s version. Just picked one at random here. Tripod aligns with a group of pedophiles who kidnap a 5-year-old girl who's been exposed to chemicals intended to force her into puberty in order to impregnate her.
I'm glad we didn't watch that one.
Wow,
This one
no context drop there.
Yeah, compared to that description, this one is relatively tame.
Yeah. I think. Wow. You know, there are Cronenbergs that I have not subjected you to. I'm just going to say I have provided for you only the best Cronen monster gooey fests. Yeah.
Yeah.
This was my first Cronenberg.
What? How could that be true?
It's totally true. And it's a weird place to start. And I'm very amused about this.
The only other thing that I have seen with Cronenberg is Discovery, Star Trek Discovery, where it has
Wait, you haven't seen The Fly?
No.
Oh, wow. What's the most mainstream Cronenberg? Is it The Fly?
The Fly. Okay. It's The Fly, followed distantly by Existenz.
Wow, The Fly is truly, truly disgusting.
Yep. This I would rate as... more mainstream in some ways than like the majority of his content, but also I think not necessarily super comprehensible or like clear if you're not, you know, familiar with the background. So, you know, I imagine there are some things that like Thomas may have picked up on that Callie may not have because of the differences in those experiences. I also think that this movie kind of exemplifies that Cronenberg works best in a not shiny environment. And this one's a little too like high gloss, I feel like, for his approach. Like he's a gritty Philip K. Dickey kind of grossness. And I feel like, yeah, anyway, that was just sort of
it reminded me. OK, what's the bug one that your dad helped us with? Because it felt a lot like that one. That's
Naked Lunch.
Was that Cronenberg?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
okay.
That was our second Cronenberg.
A lot like that. Like if you sub out kind of the plot of, you know, the intricacies of what's happening and just the atmosphere of it and like the ways people were interacting, it's a lot like that where there's different factions of people with these goals that are whatever. So I'm going to need your dad to call in and explain this movie to me because I did not understand Naked Lunch and I don't know that I understand this one. I think this one's a little bit simpler than Naked Lunch, which was incomprehensible. So
Yeah, maybe, I'm super excited to hear the two of you try to decide what happened in this movie in a second. But I do think, you know, this movie is kind of it's the sort of culmination, I feel like, of his Cronenberginess. It ties together a bunch of the movies that he's done, but you're right, it has like the common Cronenberg theme of a artist who gets caught up in a weird subculture that is like subversive and potentially trying to overthrow or bring about some new paradigm, and there's like weird layers of reality. All of that is like, you know, you see it, you know, in Existenz as well, but yeah, it's everywhere in the Cronenberg stuff.
All right, well, it's a bold move trying to pull off a three-way with your old partner and your new partner, but if anyone has the chutzpah to do it, it's one Aaron Rubinowitz.
If it can work for Viggo Mortensen and random future people.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but Kristen Stewart is not random.
Okay, fair enough. Very specific future
fight
people.
Over that.
You got to be pretty happy that you're the Kristen Stewart of the situation, aren't you?
Deeply. I mean, I get to be Leah Sadu or whatever? Because yeah, I'll take that. That's pretty much how that works. Either way, that shakes out. I'm happy, but I probably like this is slightly more happy for me. But both great. All right, okay. Let's go ahead and bop it. What do you say?
You're traveling through another dimension beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
So, Callie, if you're so great, why don't you explain the movie? Just if you're such a good host, why don't you just talk about like what it is and what happened? You're so great. Apparently, Aaron loves you so much. You must be really good. You must be so good at this. You must be just amazing at it. Why don't you
That's what I hear. Yeah,
this
I gotta
exactly
say,
how awkward. Yeah.
Again, you know, my first experience with Cronenberg, although like I wasn't completely unaware, right? Like I understood the references, and there's lots of like body horror and future like technological weirdness, and so I wasn't like entirely unprepared for what I was stepping into. But I still came out of this thinking that I like both need to thank you and hold you accountable for introducing me to this movie. So it starts with a child
quick child murder. Yeah.
Murdered.
Well, you raise a good point. Like, should this movie have a bunch of trigger warnings? Should this episode have a bunch of trigger warnings?
Really,
for things
should,
like self-harm,
actually? Yeah.
And like there's a lot of like self-violence specifically, like cutting people and things. Maybe worth mentioning on the outset here.
Yeah. Yeah, in all seriousness, definitely like trigger warning for literal child murder, all kinds of mutilation, self-mutilation and otherwise. So yeah, it's, you know, the establishing shot I actually thought was really cool. It's like the ship overturned, hanging out in this body of water, like had obviously been there for a long time and rusted, and it's, you know, you get the sense that like, you know, mm-hmm. this is either in some far off place where there is no civilization, or perhaps this is some like post dystopian future or whatever. And this kid is just like collecting stuff on the beach, and mom is like, you better not eat anything from there. You better not. And like, I don't remember the specific phrasing, but it's just, it's very weird.
Yeah, that's something in a normal movie you'd think, oh, filler line that doesn't really, you know, oh, don't eat anything. And then, no, that's the whole movie. That's actually crucial to the entire movie.
Don't you eat that random stuff you found on the beach.
Yeah.
And like deliberately ambiguous, because as you're pointing out, this is sort of a dystopian. We don't know. We don't think we ever find out what the actual time is, what the date is. And, you know, she could just mean don't eat anything because it's polluted. But like,
right.
You know,
I think as we progress through the movie, we get enough clues to see that this is probably like not a far future dystopia, but like a mid-range future dystopia, like a few decades away, maybe. Because it does the thing that a lot of funny dystopian movies do, where it's like, on the one hand, you have incredibly advanced, unimaginable technology. On the other hand, you have people using like 90s point and shoot cameras that are like would actually require that same level of technical skill to like go back and find and make work again. It's like, I get it aesthetically, but it's just very funny to me to like think about that for even 2 seconds and like, how would that actually work?
But it's on a ring. It's a ring camera.
Boy, I hope we're only 10, 20 years from one of these flesh chairs from whatever those, what would you call those?
The breakfaster?
I want those.
The bone chair.
The flesh and bone chair.
The boner chair.
Yeah. And then, you know, you cut to a very normal scene, kids brushing his teeth, as one does when you're a small child and you're doing the right thing. And then, like, sits down, like, picks up a garbage can, and it's maybe he's gonna
pick the next thing you think it's gonna be. Like, audience, pick what you think the next thing. Picks up a garbage can, and then what? What do you think? Okay, you've all take your time, fill out your answers. Everybody listening. Okay, what does a kid do with a garbage can, Callie?
He begins to eat the garbage
can. Eats the garbage can. That wasn't one of my guesses. I didn't see that coming. Just chowing down in that garbage can.
Yeah.
I definitely like had to roll back chicken. The start of this movie a few times and be like, wait, what is happening here?
Yeah. So that happens. And, you know, as this happens, you see mom looking on in, I guess, like resigned horror. Like, she's very obviously not surprised by the thing that she is seeing, which is interesting. Because, you know, I mean, I didn't do a ton of reading or research going into the movie because I kind of wanted to be surprised by how absolutely wild it was going to be, which I think was a good move on my part.
Yeah.
But yeah, mom is
yeah. Now, neither of you has kids, right? So just as a parent, when your kid starts eating a garbage can, that's not the norm. And you'd probably, just to give you some perspective, normally kids don't eat garbage cans.
That's good to know. That was a question that
this is the expertise that you're going to be missing when I leave the show. Hope you can get by without me.
I would describe her response as every woman in every Cronenberg movie ever who looks on with a kind of detached horror at some weird thing that they seem to have expected to happening. Yeah.
Yeah, she's very horrified. So much so that the next scene.
Moving right along.
Just a quick child murder. She's that's the last garbage can. She's not going back to Target for another garbage can. She's tired of replacing garbage cans, I think. And she just flat out murders the kid. Just a quick murder. I thought it was going to be like he would start eating through the pillow so he wasn't suffocated. You know, that would have been a cool way for the kid to survive. Just chomp right through it. But no.
Yeah. No. He could have been theory, though, right?
Foreshadowing, pillows aren't made of plastic, I don't think.
That's a fair point. But they basically have to turn him into the MacGuffin for the rest of the movie. That's like the opening sequence, essentially.
Right. And you know, cryptically, she's on this 90s cell phone, the big like Motorola brick cell phone, and is basically like, tell this guy to come get his dead kid.
So that's how the movie starts. And
roll credits.
So yeah, off to a wonderful start here.
Questions so far? No. Moving right along, right? We get to cut to the actual main characters of this particular movie, who are weird art people, which, again, it's a Cronenberg movie. Weird art people doing weird, sexy art stuff is the protagonists of the movie.
Yeah. And is it the first shot that we get one of Viggo Mortensen in this breakfaster chair?
It's the bed first.
Yeah, he's waking up.
Right. It's the bed. And she walks in. Oh, yeah. Because I remember my very first thought being like, wow, for this to be such a like dirty, gritty, grimy world, his art partner seems to have like very pristinely clean clothing all of the time.
Interesting.
That It's a weird detail that sticks out to me. Everyone's clothes seem very, very well taken care of in this like future dirty dystopia.
That's interesting.
Maybe it's the same reason that they're no longer getting infections or something. Maybe all the dirt has died or something. I don't. Yeah, it's not clear exactly why. Yeah, nobody's walking around with shit all over them.
Not only that, everybody should have blood all over them from all the surgeries happening all the time, right?
Right, for sure.
Interesting. That's a major, major plot hole you've just discovered. Blown the lid off that one.
That's
so yeah. What's up with this bed? Me. You know, this bed. I love these beds.
Yeah. This is so Cronenberg.
And it was a very interesting establishing shot to like rewind just a little bit. Now that you mentioned, I remember like the first shot is her like walking down this hallway, and then you see, this thing. It looks vaguely like a heart, kind of.
Yeah, or like like a bug, like a cocoon, or like a, it's very interesting, very insect-like too.
And and very slowly, as the camera moves, you can see like feet and hands, and they have a very, very weird conversation with one another that I am, I'm actually a little lost for how to, they talk about like feeling pain. And there's like this new hormone that this bed has created to inject into him.
Yeah. So I can shed a little light here, and it might help clarify some things that are going to happen along in the plot. The hormone is coming from Vigo's new organ because Vigo's an organ generator guy. The bed's function is, and this is not very clear on the first watch through, I'll be honest. You know, I think y'all probably caught that, like, people aren't feeling pain anymore in this world.
Oh, yeah.
Except for some people who specially feel pain only when they're asleep.
Yeah.
Right. I caught that. I think what I missed was that I thought that she was saying that the bed had created this new hormone to put into his body to, like, cure whatever was wrong with him.
The problem was the bed was not like dealing with his pain properly because it wasn't calibrated to the new hormone. Yeah, right. So right. It's confusing.
And I love that though. The idea that this flesh sack bed, she's like, needs an update. Or he says that one of the software updates, kind of funny. But,
you know, the bed and several other pieces throughout this movie really are very much like Existenz design evolved, right? The kind of gooey video game consoles that you plugged into in Existenz. These beds are like the bigger, like daddy version, grown up version of that. And then you get like other weird alternative versions of those along the way. But yeah, I love the like tentacles hanging down, you know, attached to his arms and stuff. But like, that's not even the only weird design we're going to get, right? Because we also get the Boninator chairs.
The Boninator.
Boninator? I missed that. Is that the name of him?
No. It's, I believe the breakfast.
It's called the, or something. The Breakfaster.
Breakfaster, yes. I think Boninator is more on point, but it's
fine. We can assume there's a sex version of that. Oh, no, we can't actually. No, sex doesn't really happen.
I was going to say,
unfortunately, there is no Boninator.
Heavily implied that those things are like one and the same, though.
What? What's one of
the weird like surgery machines and sex?
Ah, yeah, yes,
related.
All right, pro tip from an old seasoned vet, Callie. This is gonna take forever at this rate. We gotta scoot through the plot, otherwise it's gonna be four times the length of the movie.
Oh, shit, you're right. Sorry, this is just God. This opening is so fascinating. I also just had a lot of feelings to move things along. There's this weird like optical device that she like has shoved into his stomach. I feel like that happened shortly after this scene.
Yeah, just check out your new organ. Yeah. Let me take a look at that new organ. That was one I had to hear several times before my brain would accept that that's what I was hearing. I was like, he has a new organ? Like he just grew in? Nope. Yep. He did. That's what it was.
Yeah, for a movie that's often just a lot of people talking to each other in rooms, I feel like it doesn't come across that way too much, maybe in some scenes, but it's often because somebody is like stabbing somebody else with something sexually while they're having a random, you know, like info dump conversation about how like human beings are evolving in weird ways and stuff, and giving you a sense of like what the weird rules are for this Cronenberg world. So yeah, I think also important to note that like their activity, these two individuals, she's not just looking at the organ, she's actually tattooing the organ while it's inside of his body.
That's something I still don't fully grok. Is it part of the registration process? Because now I think next we have to go to the organ DMV and register your new organ that you have and surrender it, basically. Yeah.
It's actually like the prototype for the organ registry. So that you can think of it like this, you know, he's like unique in the degree to which he seems to be growing new organs all of the time. Like lots of people are having weird things happening, but to varying degrees. And he and her have a kind of anti-transhumanist worldview where they're afraid that if you build up too many changes, you'll become post-human, like a ship of Theseus with too many new organs. And so their art becomes this kind of resistance art of removing the organs, but tattooing them on the inside and then removing them and making that part of the artistic process. And it's the tattooing on the inside that inspires our friend from Slings and Arrows and Kristen to tell us, you know, to like set up a registry where they can control the like spread of new human, you know, organ information or something with this tattooing process.
Well, so it's some sort of entity, the government, the police, the whatever, does not want people evolving these new organs, kind of anti-new organ evolution. Also, he's like, Viggo Mortensen is like a real-life Johnny Hundred Livers kind of,
basically, he's literally Johnny Hundred Livers, yep.
And they don't know what the function of these organs are and stuff. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was cool to see what's-his-name from Slings and Arrows, because his voice is so different. He really, I don't know if it's the Slings and Arrows voice was more put on or this one was, but I don't know which, but I had to do a double take because I was like, yeah, that's him. No, that's not it. Yeah, that's him, because he sounds way different, but really.
And do you
really
remember that he was in Existenz as well?
Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah, okay.
But he was more recognizable in that. It's been, you know, he's a lot older now. But anyway, so yeah, then everything. I also like that every component of the society that we see, you know, police or this registry thingy, they're all just like a couple people in a room. You know, there's not a lot of like formal bureaucracy anymore. You get the sense that like maybe those structures have kind of broken down, and it's a lot of just like, oh yeah, this guy's in charge of this, or, you know, I got that indication anyway.
Oh yeah, I definitely felt that.
I think it's a lot like Philip K. Dick again, where it's like you have two levels of control. You have the weird schlubby bureaucracy, and then you have the dude that Viggo keeps meeting with who appears to be like a very effective sort of serious cutthroat operative from a more secret, more anti-transhumanist wing of the government.
Yeah, but even he's just dressed like a guy, doesn't have any, you know, I feel like maybe that the kind of officialness of all of that, the trappings of that stuff is not present in this world.
Just a regular guy with a giant boil on his stomach.
An artistic boil.
Artistic boil. So I mean, you know, organ DMV. That's a great way of putting that. There's like a very quick like preliminary conversation, I think, and then we move to the organ DMV. And like, I just cannot emphasize enough, I don't generally have celebrity crushes, but Kristen Stewart is just the biggest gay crush on her. Oh my god.
And they give her stuff to do in this one, for sure. I feel like she gets some pretty choice lines.
Oh, does she ever? Holy shit. I really could not decide if her affect in this movie is brilliant acting or terrible acting.
Oh my gosh. Okay, I'm glad you said that.
It bothers me that it is maybe both.
No idea. Can't tell. I feel like she probably did what the director wanted. So, it's bad, but it feels like everybody's trying to be bad in that way. So maybe it's good. I don't know.
This is again like a classic Cronenberg trope. Are the people in Cronenberg movies bad actors or brilliant actors? Keep watching them over and over again. You'll never know. It's hard to tell. It's a thing. Like I don't know what the answer to the question is. I had the same problem where the first time I watched this, I thought she was like one of the weaker links in the weird gooey sex chain. And then I rewatched it. I'm like, wait, no, is she actually doing some really interesting stuff in some of these scenes? But yeah, it's Cronenberg, you know, weird direction. Still fascinating to watch, though. Well, and like kind of hot.
I mean, like, I guess to foreshadow a little bit later in the movie, I will say that this is going to be one of the weirdest things I've ever said, but I'm just going to say it. I kind of found her making it a little more easier for me to like suspend disbelief and like get into the world, because I think anyone who's found themselves being like into something that's taboo, like she definitely did a good job of putting that energy forward.
Yeah. Both of them did. I thought actually both of those two characters give like were like the team parasocial fetish relationship, and like they really pulled it off, I thought.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is, I mean, it's funny to say, but it's also true that like I think anyone who has surprisingly found themselves like more interested in like kink or fetish stuff and feels the need to like talk to somebody about, even if it's something that is like in the real world much more mundane, like, you know, being into bondage or whatever, right? Like if you have a certain upbringing, you're taught to like feel awkward about that and that there's something wrong with that. And I very much identified with the, like, it just being really, really awkward to try to have that conversation with someone, because like it's so exciting but it's taboo, and like you don't know how to talk about it because it feels just like such an alien thing to your world. And I just like I saw so much of myself in that specific energy of hers.
Yeah, and Thomas is right that we gotta push along here a little bit, but to sort of highlight what you're describing, one of my favorite moments in the movie is after they've done their first performance. So, you know, the world, everybody has lost their sense of pain, so there's a rise in like, you know, degenerate quote unquote behavior. You have these like fetish dens where people are doing weird performance art to try to give you the feels again, and they do that thing, you know, where they cut out one of his organs and show it off and talk about what it represents, blah blah blah. And then afterwards there's like a party, and I've been to like performance art, and there
I've been to post public surgery parties like,
I've been to like weird art that involved nudity that were like the people in front of you were like really nude and doing weird things on stage. Ooh, and then afterwards they come out in a robe and everybody's drinking and chatting. Yeah. And this scene captured that vibe perfectly. Yeah. Right, like all of them people milling around while he's like lying on a bed and she's like holding his hand and they look like they've just had sex, and then like Kristen like awkwardly walks over to be like, I need to talk to you about how this is really sex, how absolutely this is all about sex.
Yeah.
And she just very very suddenly blurts out something like, I want you to cut me.
Yeah,
I really want to be the person that you're cutting. Yeah, yeah. I wanted you to be cutting into me. Yeah,
I actually had to pause for a second and like laugh my way through, because it was just like, oh, okay, we're just going straight on with it, which like shouldn't be a surprise by this point in the movie.
Yeah, but in the previous scene, it's a giant bone tentacle with a knife on it that's just like really railing on Viggo Mortensen's midsection, and he's clearly like orgasming during it. Right. Like that's the previous scene, so she's not out of place when she's like, you know, surgery is the new sex.
Right.
Yeah, that's an important point of this world, and that seems to be true. And a lot of the things are made more clear with that in mind. So that's an important plot point. Let's see what else, try to catch us up time wise here. So the main plot, as you say, the MacGuffin, the child who could have been named MacGuffin, really, is that the child's dad wants Viggo and company to do a public autopsy of the kid to show that you know what's inside, because he believes that the kid, I think he correctly believes that the kid just evolved, just was born with the organs that allow him to digest plastic in a way that the dad and a bunch of this, like, this is this other faction, is the dad at the plastic eater faction. You see him the whole time. I thought he was just crunching down power bars, but they're like sheets of plastic or something. He's just munching them down the whole time. And you get a quick scene where someone else tries to eat it and just like dies instantly. So I missed that kind of the first time, but, and so that's the main, I guess, kind of driving plot is the idea that they might perform this as their act, perform this autopsy of the kid, see what's inside. The big reveal would be, oh, there's no surgery has been done. He was just born this way. And so that's kind of the main thing happening. I don't understand who the two ladies are that kill people. Can you, Aaron, do you? I didn't get that part. I kind of missed it.
I thought they were a lot of fun, but I also functionally don't understand.
I love them.
Are they the same ones
so
who were all of a sudden posing naked in that chair thing?
They were.
Yes.
They were.
So how does that fit with...
For sake of time, I will not do this in the, you know, exploratory learning style. I'll just lay it out here for you. So much like many people in Cronenberg movies, these two characters, I think, are meant to be agents, parts of probably the same organization as the dude who keeps showing up and talking to Viggo Mortensen. And they show up a couple of times over the course of the movie. First, they're the people who show up to fix his bed in the first sequence. And they are the ones who are really excited about the sarcophagus bed that is used for autopsies, but they use it for their sex performance surgery. And then they show up again with the female performer in that sequence where they are, as far as we can tell, just like hanging out with her and then having a threesome on the table, I think. Because as far as we can tell, they're just like kind of groupies, like they're really into these people because everyone is, because they're very famous artists. And then what we find out, I think, ultimately is they were part of sort of manipulating this event so that it would work out for the anti-transhumanist faction instead of the transhumanist plastic eaters. And then the final sequence is they just, you know, they murder the father so that there's no loose ends or anything.
I think it's possible they are not part of the government agency, but are part of like a corporate part of it, more like a maintaining, if they work for the makers of Bone Chair,
they have
interest in not having people evolve away from it. I think that's what it was.
Nope, you're totally right, because
they're repair technicians for this organic technology, Acme Bonerizers.
Yeah, and the ultimate reveal of the story is that the transhumanist plastic eaters are actually the naturalists of this world. They think that it's normal and natural to evolve in this way to become plastic eaters. And the government is trying to prevent it. And the corporation, as you say, you're right, is trying to prevent it by, because they, you know, the machines that they create are to allow people who are evolving in this way to continue to eat old, normal things instead of plastic. So yeah, that's a good point.
So, it would be great if we evolved to eat plastic. I think that, one thing that I don't know if you guys caught, but apparently Cronenberg wrote this script 20 years ago, and he says that he didn't change anything. Like, it just sat for 20 years.
Oh, interesting.
And he says he did not change a word, but the production kind of would have shifted, obviously, which I think is weird. I saw some of the quotes associated with this production, and they all, I think, made me think less of it, which isn't great. I'm not sure what he's going for. It was he said like, oh yeah, I didn't change a word, didn't edit it, didn't whatever 20 years ago. And part of me is like, oh well, maybe you should, you know, like maybe you should take a look at that. And the other thing was like, oh, we didn't do any more than like two takes per scene or something. It's like, maybe you could have done a few more takes. I don't know. Like, what's the guarantee that you would have gotten this weird ass movie scene correct the first couple of times? It's a very out there concept. I feel like it might take a little practice, you know, but so that was weird. I don't know why that would be crucial to the production of this.
I'm not sure I felt the takes were bad. I think some of the pacing was a little slow in some of the scenes, especially in the second half. But I was going to mention Existence comes out in 1999, so that would be 20 years ago plus. So it is plausible to me that he wrote this as a sequel to Existence and then shelved it back then and has finally made it. And like, I mean, part of, you know, a little to get us moving towards the philosophy a little, but I think part of the point of this movie is a kind of statement of an artist saying, I've run all the numbers, you know, I've run all the versions of this weird Cronenberg creature thing that I'm clearly obsessed with, and I'm a little tapped out. Like, I think he feels tapped out, and I think this feels like it represents that essentially.
Oh, interesting. I think it's also just an honorable mention because I honestly am not sure that it has any larger bearing in the plot, but there's this interesting concept of the inner beauty pageant that happens.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, which we never really find out.
But it's also like an underground thing. Yeah, that doesn't really resolve that well.
No.
Yeah.
It's some weird subplot about him getting pulled into,
But also Viggo ends up being undercover cop or something, right? Did I understand?
Yeah, Viggo works for the government. So Viggo is a snitch as far as we can tell.
That felt weird and unnecessary to the plot. I didn't really understand why. But
well, I don't know. I got the sense that he was fulfilling the role of like the most effective like propagandist, where he's like afflicted with this condition and doing his best to like push it off and like affirm that it's this unnatural state of being. And so like I could imagine, you know, if there's a government that has a very big interest in preventing that sort of thing, that he would be like a good get for them as like a public representative of resistance to this idea that it's okay for humanity to move along. I'm not sure that I understand what his motivation would be to go along with it, but I think that explains the government's interest in it.
Yeah.
Unless he also just has this like deep uncomfortability with all of that. Like, I don't know. Unless they're just like paying him a lot of money or something like that. Like,
I get the impression that it's more like he represents this kind of subordinated artist who has internalized the kind of dominant anti-trans, anti-trans humanist, but also anti-trans. Like, he's almost in a sense a kind of detransitioner in this sense, like a continual detransitioner. I really don't think that's an accident. Like, I really do think that's part of all of this.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, what we see in the final scene, just to kind of get us a little bit to the end of the plot here, is that he's in the chair and he can't eat, and she finally offers to feed him one of the, like,
I think we need to say, I think people won't understand what happened. So they do the autopsy on the kid, and then they find, oh no, it is a surgical thing where the kid, you know, and then it turns out that was kind of faked by the police officer guy, or at least his agency, to make it, because they're covering for the fact that this evolution is happening. And then, as you, I think you already alluded to, the two corporate people murder the dad as well, because I guess he knew the truth maybe. And at the end, it's not clear that they were even working in tandem. It seems to be they just both want the same thing. But then after, you know, I think somehow or another they confirm, or I guess the policeman kind of confirms that, like, yeah, he was evolved. Like, they didn't need surgery to eat the trash cans. And then at the end, as you say, Viggo he just can't even eat normal food anymore. He's so uncomfortable. The bonerizer, the breakfaster is just not even working. And so she hands him one of those plastic wafers, just those hunks of plastic. And the last shot is a weird zoom in black and white thing that I did not. That was a bizarre shot, that last way they did it. But it's him, being able to eat and enjoy the plastic wafer. Finally.
I kind of read that as a moment of him like being radicalized and realizing that he'd been on the wrong side this whole time and is ready to, you know, join this underground movement or whatever. I thought that was pretty great.
Yeah,
and this is a reference apparently to the 1928 silent film. You know, it comes off to me immediately as like a, you know, a lot of these, you know, a lot of film buffs like to, you know, bring stuff from really old movies back in, of course. And this one, let's see.
Yeah, it did look like it had to be an homage or something because it was so out of place.
Yeah, so the original shot is from The Passion of Joan of Arc, which actually ties into what I was going to say about the kind of religious allegory here. A legendary silent film. It's a century old, considered one of the greatest movies ever made. And you know, it's the story of Joan of Arc, and it's got a shot of her crying as she's praying, I guess, as the final shot. And there is a kind of Pieta, you know, the Christ being held image in this final scene where he's being held by the chair, and he, like, you know, stops resisting and transcends the internalized self-hatred and has a moment of, like, genuine peace finally.
Yeah.
And it's a very transcendent religious experience, I think.
Yeah, well, and it's forgetting for a second the, like, absurdity of all of the world building and stuff. Like, there was, I thought it was really well done when he, you know, he takes a bite of this, like, purple plastic bar, and because, like, throughout the movie you get the sense that these weird bone machines, like, can sense when something's going wrong, and their purpose is to, like, correct whatever that is. And so they make a reference in the movie to the chair, like, moving you around to aid digestion and make you more comfortable and that sort of stuff. And, like, he takes a bite of the plastic thing and the chair just, like, turns off. And it's just like, oh shit. All right. He's all good now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He's at peace. Right. And it also, to me, like, you know, and maybe I guess we're at the point where we should transition into the philosophy side of things here, I guess.
Yeah.
Is it time to grok it? Should we get into the grok it chair?
I'm curious if Callie's going to develop a catchphrase. You have some time.
I'm going to have, you know, to. Yeah. Warp me.
There you go. Make it so.
You got to pick your favorite engage, right?
Right.
So many options.
Let's philosophize.
Why don't you just tell me the right answer?
Well, that's what's so great about the trolley problem is that there is no right answer.
This is why everyone hates moral philosophy professors.
Yeah, so I mean, there's obviously lots of weird, creepy layers here, but to just follow up on that last moment, it's, you know, it's tied to this Christ-like religious stuff, but I also think there's a lot of the, like, Buddhist, you know, absence of suffering kind of thing where, you know, he's been attached to this idea of being an old kind of human and resisting the nature of reality. And so he experiences all this unnecessary suffering. And when he finally accepts the true, you know, like, just accepts reality, accepts for what is, he can kind of be released and at peace in this way. And the, like, it reminds me of the traditions in those domains where people would sometimes eat, you know, refuse or eat, like, particularly not pleasant things as part of that process of cultivating non-attachment. And it's sort of ironically inverted that in this world, you know, trying to eat normal food is the weird attachment, and, like, eating that stuff is, you know, non-attachment in that way.
I was thinking a lot after the movie was over, and I don't know, you know, how deep of a view this is, but it's interesting to me that, obviously, because of the context, the way that it's presented, like, obviously, you know, it shocks the conscience, and there's, you know, cutting and mutilation and surgical, all that sort of stuff that to us is very just, like, way beyond the pale, totally out there. And so my instinct is to see him as this sort of, like, rebellious, subversive artist type, because that's what that art looks like to me. But it's interesting that in this universe, his art actually represents trying very desperately to hold on to the status quo.
Oh, interesting.
And
that's a good
the
point.
Very end of the movie is him being finally, like, radicalized against that. And I, like, that was very interestingly subversive to me. And I was like, it was, like, really, really satisfying after it was over. I was thinking about it and I was just like, oh shit. Like, 10 minutes after the movie's over, I'm like, I like, retroactively enjoyed it more.
Yeah. And I do think you could argue someone like Cronenberg, who has not gotten to be super ridiculously famous, because I think they've made genuinely transgressive art as compared to, you know, they'd be making a legitimate criticism that a lot of what our media treats as transgressive art has this kind of sexual, objectifying, dominating aspect of transgression, but is not genuinely subversive about sort of values and that sort of thing. And so it is that kind of, I totally agree with you, there's a kind of critique of that copping out that people are doing, but also maybe a little bit of a recognition for Cronenberg himself that, like, you know, his gooey, you know, bug anus transgression has been co-opted by society too, right? He's Rick and Morty now. He's mainstream in that kind of way. And so maybe all artists get inevitably co-opted in this kind of way.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a great point. I really like it. It's like they thought they were doing the like progressive kind of boundary expanding thing. And then in the end, as you say, Callie, it's like, no, that was status quo. Maintaining the status quo. It's also funny to me, like slightly different point, but I just love how contingent all our, I don't know, our like human desires, our sexual desires or whatever. It's like, you know, we see stuff that they're doing that's supposed to be sexual and it's like, oh, that's gross to us. But really, like, it's all relative. Like, if we evolved to where we had different, you know, needs and different, I don't know, goals sexually, I guess, like, yeah, like things would just shift. If we were a different species, if a species looks at our porn, it's like absurd. They're like, what is that? That's nothing.
Let me, well, I want to hop on that. Oh, yeah, go ahead, Callie.
I think it's going a little far to assume that everything we see in that movie shocks the conscience sexually for the modern day. Just throwing that out there.
And I wonder what y'all's thoughts are about the kind of assumption that I do think is common, which is that if we felt less pain, and that, you know, it's indicative of the way that we are desensitized in the modern world to increasingly, you know, exploitative or violent content, you know, do you really think that like if humans stopped feeling pain in this kind of way, that degenerate behavior would go up, you know, in like for people to try to feel something, they would be engaged in increasingly self-destructive behavior in this kind of way?
Without a doubt. I mean, I don't say this to trivialize, this is like a very, very serious thing that I've heard for a lot of people, like that is often a motivation for self-harm, is the fact that's like, I am out of ways to make myself feel literally anything at all. And so this is the next step. You know, like, I mean, it's not always that, right? But like, that's a thing that I've heard from multiple people that, you know, it's not about wanting to die. It's not about wanting anything to end. It's just about like being so numb that you're desperate for some sort of stimulation, some sort of sensation, that it's like you feel like you have to go to that extreme for there to be anything to feel. And I think, yeah, in a world where it was like really common to not be able to experience physical pain like that, I think. Because I think there's probably something to be said about, it's a cliche, but like a lot of our experience of the things that we enjoy comes in the context of the things that hurt and are painful, right? Like that's how that comparison, I think, works, even sometimes on a subconscious level. And to just like lose all reference point for that, I think that would, you know, I think it would probably be a bit much to say like, oh, that definitely for sure would happen. But like, it's very, very easy for me to see that being a possible outcome. Like, that's not hard for me to believe at all.
And I totally agree. And it occurs to me, you know, another big theme throughout the Cronenverse is a desire for vulnerability. And that like the submission to pain or the need to feel, you know, one of the quotes in the movie was a desire to be opened. And I think, you know, that like when people are doing that kind of self-harm, it is an attempt at like feeling vulnerable when they are, you know, resistant to feeling vulnerable in much of their time, or feel like they have to armor up for so much of the time. And I think the idea in this movie that like, surgery becomes this kind of sex is that it becomes a kind of vulnerability, a new way to feel vulnerable towards other people. And that can be really messy, right? It can be really, but like there's another one
in a
where
literal
they say,
sense,
right. But they talk about like creating meaning out of emptiness, this kind of, you know, finding a way to create something that feels like it matters.
Well, and I think that is also very often the motivation for any sort of sexual intimacy that involves a power exchange, right? Like, you know, with like BDSM, for example, obviously I can't, you know, claim to speak to everyone's motivations, but like it's a common thing that the appeal for that is that specific type of vulnerability, especially if you're a person who feels like you can't have anything resembling that kind of vulnerability in your everyday life, you know, in work or whatever. Like, part of what's appealing about that is that vulnerability, and specifically, like, in the context of this movie, not just about self-harm, but giving other people the capacity, like you're laying in a bed and there's this machine that has scalpels, like, this person could just kill you if they wanted to with pressing this, like, weird bug button of some kind that controls this machine.
Yeah. Up, down, up, down, back, back. What? No, I already forgot. What's the Konami code?
I was super into that controller.
A, B, A, C, A, B, B.
And that controller reminded me a lot of the Naked Lunch keyboards in terms of its gooiness and weirdness. I think that definitely is sort of the idea there with these, like, surgery tables, is that you really are putting yourself at the complete whims of these other people. I know we are starting to run short on time. There was, like, two other things that I thought were worth throwing in here, and one was a kind of aesthetics philosophy discussion that's going on throughout about what counts as art, and like a kind of connecting it to organization, right? So the lady's criticism of this accelerated evolution syndrome, she says an organ needs organization, otherwise it's just designer cancer, which I loved as a great, you know,
that
Cronin
is a
line.
Great line.
Yeah, but it's an interesting point, and, you know, it's echoed in the other guy's comment about, like, is this tumor on my side art? Is it Picasso? Like, can you have art that is this kind of organic thing, or does it have to be designed in some way for a purpose or for a point or something like that?
Yeah, I think that it, I mean, it's entirely, we have AI art now, you know, and we have, you know, and I think that brings up interesting questions, because if you can't tell whether or not a human made it, then essentially I think it'd be hard to say it's not art if it was made by humans, and if it, you know, if it was made by robots, and it is, if it wasn't, if we get to the point where you can't distinguish. But for me, I don't know, I guess I think a critical part of any art that I like is that human connection of knowing someone made it, and of kind of imagining and feeling what they were trying to make me imagine and feel with it. And so I do think that talking about art that's just truly random, or if it's AI generated in a way that's not, you know, not intentional or sort of, I think you do lose that, even if you could sometimes make that up in your own mind without knowing it, you know, like you could create like almost a fictional artist that made it, in your own mind. But I do think you'd lose something without that human connection there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A thing that I often think about, especially with people just loving to tear each other apart over whether AI art is art or not. Like, there's part of me that's just super exhausted with that discussion and wondering why people feel the need to debate it in the first place. But I mean, I kind of get it. And I always think about how, like, you know, newspapers were going to be the thing that was, like, too far in taking people's attention away. People said the same thing about books, and people said the same thing about the internet and all that sort of stuff. And so there's, like, there's always this thing with, like, the old thing and the new thing, and is the new thing a real version of the old thing or not? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not that I think those discussions are meaningless, but I do think that I don't quite understand the motivation and the need to adjudicate questions like that, because I'm thinking about, for me, like, my relationship with art is like, does this make me feel something? Does it make me feel what the artist wanted me to feel, or does it make me feel something different? Right? Like, I hear musicians say all the time, like, I don't want to tell you what these lyrics are really about because I don't want you to, I don't want your perception of the thing to be ruined by the reason that I created it originally. And I'm just like, I don't understand any of that.
Yeah. Like, what do you mean? In what
to
way?
Quote Vigo, right? Why does there have to be a new sex?
Well, right. Like, I don't understand, for example, like, if I have an interpretation of a song that makes it mean a lot to me, and then I find out the artist meant something completely different by it. I don't experience things in a way that like I truly understand why that would ruin someone's experience of a thing.
Oh, interesting. I couldn't be more opposite on that.
Yeah. And really so fascinating. I feel the same way about the discussion around art, right? Like I don't know that I get why there is such a focus on defining what is and isn't, right? Like I just like to look at things in terms of like, does this make me feel something?
I agree with you there. Yeah. You know, no,
I feel a little guilty because I understand the artist's preference to like not have to explain their art. And here I am doing a podcast where I overanalyze people's art all the time.
Yeah.
But I also,
but that's,
you know,
still
I think,
fundamentally different than the artists themselves just coming out.
Right. Of course. Yeah. I know. I'm just, you know, I understand why, you know, they might not want to come have a conversation with me about this, but I do think there's a way we can sort of reframe the question of, is this art, to a way that like, what Callie is saying about how do different kinds of art make us feel? Because I think one of the parts of the discussion here, you know, Thomas, you were saying the feeling of having something made by an individual and that connection to that person. It's interesting in this movie, you have that, but the person is making the thing in a way that is organic and undirected in a way that might make it feel not like art to some people, but like art to other people. And that might impact the personal nature of the connection. But like people in this, you know, world like Kristen are having very personal connections, it seems like, to the art. And then you have this added question of like, does the organ need the tattoo on top of it for it to count as art? So then you have the like directed design, or can the organ itself just stand as art, as this purely organic but, you know, personalized construction?
Well, I don't know about organs, but no, I find this conversation really interesting because in thinking through myself, I both think that if I enjoyed a piece of art, like, you know, music or whatever, I connected with lyrics and then I found out it was mindlessly AI generated, but just done like iteratively so that, you know, maybe it learns what creates a response in somebody. That would fundamentally ruin it for me. Like, I think because I don't know why, like I really want to, I really want to experience that connection of minds in a way, with the artist. Like, I really want to feel like a human being, who is going through the same things I'm going through, like, and just, you know, figuring out what it's like to be alive and to figure that out. I want to feel like it came from that. But at the same time, what's really funny that what Callie was saying just made me realize is I don't want that too much, because I don't want to know exactly what the artist intended. Do you want like a little bit of room to be able to put your own stuff in there, you know? But like, so it's this interesting line where it has to be, you know, it has to be intentional. And there has to be an artist intention that I want to connect with, but I don't want to know exactly what it is. I think it's, to me, it makes perfect sense, but it's kind of contradictory in some ways.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, a thing that I think about is, because I come from a music background, right? Like there are a lot of,
yeah, same,
you know, there's a lot of debate over, you know, if you have a MIDI keyboard and you make all of your music with a MIDI keyboard inside of a computer, are you really making music?
Oh,
right?
That's like, stupid. No, like, really?
Well, right. Yeah.
There's people on the other side of that. That all music is that now. Like literally, well, people don't even play instruments anymore.
and that, you know, there are people who like, who will say that, you know, if you watch a live band, right, and there are keyboard tracks playing from a tape at the soundboard, I mean, you know, despite there being live guitar and live singing and all of that, like people have a fundamental problem with that because that's like, you can't call that live music anymore. Right.
Right.
And of course there is a line between like, you just hooked up a computer to a PA system.
Yeah. Yeah. And you paid to see your favorite artist right. And all they did was hit play on something. I get why that sucks.
But like, at what point do we draw that line? Because yeah. I could see a world, I don't actually feel this way, by the way, but like I could see a world where you could make that same argument about a guitar amplifier, right? Mm. Like when you're making music, you plug a guitar into a guitar amp. The guitar amp fundamentally changes that sound in a way that you probably have nothing to do with because you didn't design that circuit. You didn't make any of that happen. And so like the thing fundamentally changes because of a tool that you had nothing to do with and maybe don't even know how to use properly, right? Like, does that fundamentally change the way that
I don't think we've ever felt like a violinist needs to have known how to make a violin, right?
Well, right. But I think, like, I think if I, like, if I wanted to be pedantic in theory, like, I could make that argument. Or, like, you know, because everyone is so used to hearing, like, a traditional sort of acoustic violin that, like, all of a sudden, if you have an electric violin, is that really playing violin? You know, like, I could envision a world where I could make those arguments. And it feels to me like there's this like fuzzy space in between, like to make the comparison, in between everything you hear from the PA is being created live in real time by a person. And I plugged a computer into a PA system. Like, that's not a binary situation, right? At some point, it's not fundamentally a person-driven thing. It's fundamentally a computer-driven thing. But then, like, there was a person who, like, made and recorded all of that stuff in the studio. And so, like, I think a lot of those questions are why I tend to stay away from those kinds of arguments. Because I think I could easily make the argument at all points on that spectrum. And if I made the most effective argument that I could think of, I'm not sure what it would fundamentally change about the way I enjoy a thing, you know, like whether I like enjoyed watching this movie or I saw a picture somewhere. I mean, similarly, like I'm looking at a tree outside my house that's very pretty. Is that tree art? Because if we're going to say like, you know, an internally created organ is art without someone tattooing a thing on it, like, you know, I don't understand why I would feel motivated to debate that question because like I can just appreciate it and the way that it makes
me
feel.
I'm looking forward to you trying to engage with Aaron's view that there is such a thing as like objectively better and worse art. I'm looking forward to that.
Well,
because I don't think there is really. I don't argue.
Yes, you do. You certainly do.
I consider things on my own. No, I don't. I consider things for myself. I think I'm the same way with Kelly. Like when I say I don't want to know the artist's true intentions, I'm not saying that that also has to be how anyone else prefers art. I'm just saying that's for me. I think there are a lot of people who are like, I want to hear the podcast about the person telling about everything they did went into this song. And I'm like, that would ruin it for me.
I think that's confusing belief in objective value with belief in absolutist value. I think you're assuming that everybody has to like art the same way to believe that there are objectively better and worse kinds of art. But to tie it back to our weird movie, I think it's worth noting that like this movie is about this issue in the sense that the two artists are using technology for mediated sex, right? She's not literally cutting him open with her own hands. She's using a machine. If it was just Vigo and the machine just like automatically cut him open with no sort of engagement, I think it would be a very different artistic performance than like her willing moving the machine as her limbs kind of thing that creates like more like what Thomas is saying, where it's like there's a connection between them and that connection is, you know, experienced by the, you know, people as well. But some, you know, like purists could come along and say, oh, but you're not literally physically cutting him. And that mediates your connection to him, right? It would be more real if you were doing it physically. But I think that's false, as Callie is saying, that you can have just as much real connection via this weird sarcophagus machine.
Yeah, I think it's very individual because I think there are some people who would feel like, oh, I would have more of a connection this way. And some people wouldn't feel that way. And I'm just more like, okay, cool. Like, that's how you experience it. So that's fine. Mm-hmm. And like, as opposed to trying to like adjudicate how real or not real that is, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And because this is the last show, I think it's fitting to go out on. Aaron, I wasn't offering that as an argument for why you were wrong. Those are two separate thoughts. I was saying you have an objective view of art and I'm looking forward to Callie experiencing that. But also my, my view is like, yeah, whatever. I'm done. I'm not trying to like argue that anyone else should want to experience art the same way I do.
That's fair. I think that's a fine position, certainly.
I had a whole band that got ruined for me because I listened to a band and went and saw the show.
Uh-huh.
And it was so the opposite of my preference. Like the guy just went into excruciating detail on what the songs were about and why. Mm-hmm. And it was so,
in my view,
worse than what I had imagined. It was like artificial. It was like, yeah, this is about two girls and they have like psychic powers to, I'm like, what the fuck?
Never meet your heroes when your heroes are
completely ruined. I have literally not listened to it since. It's been 5 years. And I used to really like the songs. It just like completely ruined it for me.
Could have been worse. It could have been like, nope, this one's about white power. This one's about white power.
Oh, yeah. No, it was. I mean, that would be worse in a sense, but I mean, it can't get much worse. I never listened to it again. So
you could feel active regret for having supported a white nationalist.
Yeah.
I think,
but yeah, you're fair.
I think that was very much shaped for me by the fact that I grew up listening to a lot of hardcore and metal, and there was a very specific style of that music that was, it was basically 90% of the bands that played that kind of music were Christian bands. And so I just had to get used to it. Yeah. Like I just had to get used to the idea that like, I'm just going to have to figure out what this means to me on my own and just be okay with that, because these guys are definitely singing about Jesus and that means nothing to me.
Yeah, my genres, you know, you just have to bite the bullet that you're going to read a bunch of racist, misogynist creators, because otherwise there's this whole decades that you're just going to have to skip.
Right.
Yeah, but wouldn't you have been better off if you never found out that actually this was, instead of being about some nice relationship or some interesting human relationship, it's about some BS with Jesus or something. Wouldn't you have been better off? You would have been able to enjoy the art.
Well,
never
it's a about Jesus
that.
At the end, it turns out. It really is actually Jesus at the end.
That's what I'm saying. It would be better if you never had learned
if
that
I hadn't
about
known
a
that,
given
if I hadn't
song,
known that one fact.
Yeah. Would it be too much to ask you to define better off?
Well, and that's an interesting point because, you know, artists use references, right? Cronenberg is using a deliberate Christian reference there. And generally, we assume it's better to understand art more deeply, to understand more of the references, but maybe along Thomas's lines of like, I don't actually want to know what the artist means too much sometimes. Maybe you're better off not knowing that that's a Jesus reference or something so that you can just think it's a weird shot. Yeah, no, I'm following.
Yeah.
Well, and I can't say that there's no line at which that happens, because I used to be a really, really big fan of this band Brand New. They were super, super big in like early 2000s emo kind of thing.
Yeah, I remember.
And then like turns out their singer was a sexual predator, and that made all of their breakup songs like, what this was about now. And that's one case in which like learning
remember that,
that absolutely ruined
Plain White Tees, was it that song? Oh. There was like, hey there, Delilah. And then someone was like, yeah, that was about him like stalking someone. You're like, oh, now I don't like that.
I was going to say, given like Bare Naked Ladies, that like 90% of Bare Naked Ladies songs are about really bad breakups, I would be really depressed to find out if like, no, they're just actually really abusive guys writing songs about how abusive they are.
Which like honestly, like how many, I mean,
I happen to like Bare Naked Ladies. Thank
there are so many breakup songs, and I bet a shocking and horrifying number of them exist in that context.
Sure.
Well, a lot of like art throughout history has been, you know, especially stuff from a long, long time ago, the majority of it is, you know, the majority of it that society valued enough to keep is written by men.
Right.
And so it's like, oh, is this devotional poem you being an absolute creep? Probably, you know,
right.
Like,
yeah,
it's hard. Yeah, it's interesting. Well, I think we should probably leave the main show for there, unless you want a closing philosophy thoughts there, Aaron.
Yeah, final thoughts. I guess was just one of the things that made me pick this one was we were talking about the weirdness of podcasts in general, where in not maybe like, you know, Callie can talk about how not professional, but in like some professional, but you know, in parts of podcast world that I'm used to, people sort of see these things as things that go on infinitely, where a lot of art is often sort of, you know, you have a band for a while or a show for a while or relationships for a while, and then you go on and do other projects, and that's good and healthy. And I think this movie has vibes of that.
You're saying I ought to embrace eating plastic.
Right.
Just
right.
embrace, just start eating plastic and stop being in denial.
Yeah, I'm assuming that recording Dear Old Dads is a lot like eating plastic. That's pretty much what I'm saying. Yeah. I mean, Eli literally is this character, right? He like probably could eat plastic at this point, probably be happier if he could.
Right.
Well, as long as it's, I was going to say
vegan plastic.
Yeah, as long as it's vegan. Yeah, vegan plastic. Yeah. Although, wait, is plastic vegan?
I think all plastic is probably vegan plastic, right?
I think it's all probably not.
Well, it's all dinosaurs. So.
Yeah, exactly. It's all animal product.
Have to be, you know, how far removed from an animal far enough back, is it okay?
That's true. Because I mean,
in that case, no one is actually
exactly
vegan.
Like nobody. Every plant is probably somewhere along the line, you know, so fertilizer of something with something. Yeah, good point. So maybe plastic's fine. I don't know. Yeah, I think that's great. I think it'll be cool to have a new iteration of the show. I'm looking forward to it. And also, yeah, I just want to say thanks to you, Aaron, and to the listeners for like really exposing me to a lot of organ eating or whatever. A lot of
exposing is the right word for this show, I feel.
Really forever traumatizing me with various flesh bags being torn open and giblets falling out, you know, just over the years. It's been a true thing. And
for a hot second, I thought I was about to witness a very tender, warm moment.
Yeah, he'll never look at Cronin monsters the same way again. I watched the Rick and Morty episode, and a little tear.
I thought the organs were very warm and tender, personally. But I'll tell the chef. But yeah,
you got to tenderize them properly. It's important.
Fair enough.
Yeah. No, it's been a lot of. There's so much stuff I never would have, consumed. So much content I never would have consumed. So many organs I never would have consumed. Had it not been for this show, it's been really fun. So, and don't be a stranger. Well, we're gonna do some After Dark, I'm sure. But for the normies here, I hope to, come back from time to time if you'd like. But yeah, I'm gonna miss you guys. I'm gonna miss the show. I'm gonna miss the listeners. Gonna miss it, but I think it's gonna be cool for everybody going forward.
Yeah, and people should listen to Dear Old Dads and Serious Inquiries Only, OA, all the things.
I think the truth is, with me having a third kid, I just think the antinatalism of our audience of this show, it just wouldn't, they would have kicked me out anyway. They're just like, but the thing is, I'm also an antinatalist.
You're just a bad one. You're an crazy.
Yeah. Like how you, Aaron, you think you should be vegetarian or vegan, but you know you can't. Right. It's like that.
Yeah. No. I think you just kind of have overpopulated our space pod a little too much, and we're just going to send you back
down. Using up too much oxygen.
Going to go repopulate the Earth, and Callie and I'll hang out here in the weird, lower deck sex party.
Ooh, have fun with the contact high. You're going to get Callie from the.
I will be a source of the contact high for sure. Yeah, there will be no simply the contact
first
high
the first contact high.
Yeah.
Oh,
took 200 episodes for that. Wow.
Nicely done.
How did we not think of that sooner?
Keeping it fresh 200 note. Episodes later.
Do you, can I ask you what next episode is? Do you have that planned yet?
We do. Actually, okay. Callie, do you want to tease the next one since we're headed off into your quadrant for a little
reading
bit?
Reading some strange energies, Captain.
Yeah.
If you get that, you're going to have a lot of fun. If you don't get it, hopefully you will also have a lot of fun.
Yeah, just Google the best Star Trek show out there, Strange Energies. You'll figure it out. It'll make sense.
I have been waiting my entire life, or the last 3 years that the show has been around, to just stand on the top of a very high mountain and preach about how I think even people who like Star Trek Lower Decks don't take it seriously enough or give it enough credit for being good and real Star Trek. And so
I need to check that out. Well,
yeah,
I guess I'll have to.
It's a thing. It's a thing we're doing.
Excellent. So any episode in particular that people should check out ahead of time or just the whole vibe of the thing?
Strange Energies is the episode we're going to be covering to start with. Okay. It's season 2, episode 1. It's very easy to binge the first season. And this is an homage, like so many of the episodes, an homage to one of the greatest of all Star Trek tropes.
Several of them.
So, love it. Which, yes, a pile of tropes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what are top patrons making you say this week?
As a human, I was ill-equipped to thank you. But as myself, you have my everlasting gratitude.
Yeah, thanks to our strong AIs who gently cuddle us so that we do not feel pain at night, patrons. Coffee and antidepressants is not breakfast. Big Easy Blasphemy. I Like Boobs and I'm Tired of Pretending I Don't. Dude, Corey Ebert, Jesta, That Bastard Neil Polzin, Jesse Urbanowitz and Brenda Goodman, Alex Arnett, and are definitely, absolutely not a clone that we've created to continue to connect to the people who we feel slightly more distant from. Our patron, We Scared Thomas Away with Terrible Movies. Thank you very much. It's fair.
Fantastic.
It's fair.
All right. Well, see you, normies. You know, if you want a little bit more of extended goodbye, then you'll have to hop on the patron bonus extra. But everybody else, I'll see you never. No, I'll see you on any of my other shows or maybe back here from time to time. And on to After Dark.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at zeroG Philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.
Well, no, that's not true. Okay.